I want to go back and finish the talk that we started yesterday. Seems like it's been longer than that, but yesterday, about the Renegade Pastor's calendar. And many of you have had something to say to me about that, or some of you have made some jokes about Parkinson's Law and some of that. So I'll get to that in just a moment. But I was joking about the newspaper and how I like to read the newspaper, and a bunch of people under 30 came up to me and said, "Now, what exactly is a newspaper?" And I tried to explain to them what this is, and then somebody gave me this this here. It's 50 things that we don't do anymore because of technological advances. And so see if you can relate. Number one is call theaters to get accurate movie times. In New York, we had the movie phone. You remember they made it popular on Seinfeld. Visit a travel agent's office to research vacations. Record your favorite things using VHS recorders. You ever find yourself saying, "Did we get that on tape?" And people are like, "What's tape?" You know, ever do that? Dial directory assistance to find someone's number. Which reminds me, what's the number for 911? Anyway, use public telephones. You know, sometimes I see that in a movie, somebody uses a public telephone. And, of course, the old comedian's joke is, if you see somebody using a public telephone, you ask, "What, are they homeless?" Number six, book tickets for events over the phone. Number seven, print photographs. Number eight, put a classified ad in a window. Call the 24-hour operator to get the exact time. I think that one's even older than me. Carry portable cassette or CD players. I thought this one was interesting. Number 11, handwritten letters. Apparently they're not reading Fusion. So because sometimes as things go more high-tech, if you move toward high touch, it'll stand out. In one of the coaching networks, somebody started writing the handwritten notes like I talk about to the first-time guest, and somebody took a picture of that, a first-time guest took a picture of that and put it on their Facebook page because it had been so long since they had received a handwritten letter. So sometimes you can go against the grain. Buy disposable cameras, take plenty of change for payphones, make mixtapes, anyone? Pay bills at the post office, I don't remember that. Use an address book, check a printed map before vacation. Of course, if you got that iPhone map, you had to get your old maps out for a while. Reverse charges and a payphone, call collect. We don't call collect anymore. Buy like a TV guide, TV listings, own an encyclopedia, register your car at a DMV. I don't know, I still have to do that, but I guess they do it online or something now. The Yellow Pages, that's dead. Look up something in a dictionary. Remember phone numbers. That's one, right? So we get so used to having that with us. And I was always like, well, what if I ever got put in jail? Would I know, like, my wife's cell number? Because it's just, you know, it's keyed. And thankfully, I've not gone to jail, so I'm okay. But use pagers. Every once in a while, you'll still hear somebody talk about that. Turn off your pagers and cell phones, you know, or something like that. I had a pager, first church I pastored. Where's Brandon? We were talking about Duke Divinity School. I did a graduate degree at Duke, and I had a pager when I was there. And they would page me if something went on at the church. That's how long ago that was. Fax documents. I don't know. I still like that. Buy CDs. Have a CD collection. Pay by check. Have you been through the stewardship seminar? People don't have checks anymore. Let's see. Warm drinks on the stove. I don't know. Dial star 69 to find out who called you last. That actually could be still really helpful, I think. As far as that, I didn't really understand this one. Number 38, tie on shoes at the mall. Do shoes just not have shoe strings anymore? Am I just out of touch with that one? I wasn't quite sure about that. Send love letters. We'll get to that one in a moment. Maybe you should do more of that. Buy flowers from a florist. Visit yard sales and flea markets. That seems like it's still pretty big, right? I thought that was still pretty big. Hang laundry out to dry. That would be one. And then buy newspapers was number 47. Keep a personal diary. Go to a dictionary to learn how to spell something. So kind of interesting list with things we don't do anymore. But these are things you still should do and you should have in your calendar. So I started the talk yesterday by saying there's three resources every leader has to work with. You have time, energy, and money. And we're going to talk about time and particularly a tool that you have, which is your calendar. And so maybe contrary to this list, you need a paper calendar, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with a paper calendar or a calendar that you can actually use and is easily accessible to you. I gave you the Peter Drucker quote that efficiency is doing things right, effectiveness is doing the right things. Then we've talked about how you personally manage your calendar and asked the question, is your calendar under control or out of control, or are you under its control? Tom Peters says you equal your calendar. Brian Tracy says your calendar equals life management. We did a study of Psalm 90, verse 12, which in the NIV says, teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Did you ever see that Transformers movie with Optimus Prime? Yeah, so okay, you owe me because I just got Optimus Prime into the talk. So it's funny what people talk about. Ephesians 5, 15 and 17, Luke 14, 28, Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 11, Psalm 39, 4 and 5, and then we got into five anchors into your calendar, but I gave you two parenthetical comments. One, keep a unified calendar, which some of you are still struggling with. How do I get this unified calendar thing going? And then a lot of fun, as you've caught me this week, about Parkinson's Law. That seemed to be a crowd favorite from yesterday. Work expands to fill the time available for its completion. And this talk will expand to the time that I have to complete it. But I'm going to try to finish early so you can take some photos and meet some people and all of that. Actually, if I end early, what I'd like to do at the end is here's some application points. Some things you've learned over the last couple days that you're going to go back and do. Not questions, but application points as we go along. But a lot of you have had fun with Parkinson's Law, and I gave you that article from lifehack.org. That takes us up to the first element in your calendar, which is the Sabbath. And that's a 24-hour period where you abstain from your primary vocation. And I really seriously do hope that you sit down with your calendar and went through and added in your Sabbath. Mine is Friday evening to Saturday night. So my Sabbath this week is going to be Friday night. I have the launch conference tomorrow. This area here will be turned into a church planting conference tomorrow with about 100 church planters. And then I'll finish that up around 4:30. And then I'll be waiting and watching as the sun goes down as I go on to Sabbath time tomorrow night. So I got to get all the sheep in the pen. Got to do my sermon run-through tonight, make a few little quick calls about Sunday, and then tomorrow night into Saturday, I will rest, recreate, reflect, and proflect as part of the Sabbath. Then number two, I think the one that we dealt with yesterday is worship, and putting worship into your calendar, which may be on top of your Sabbath, but could be also an addition. And we talked about daily worship and having your daily time with God, and then that weekly worship, which may be at your church. You may be able to find that time for weekly worship at your church, or you may have to find it somewhere else. And then the word of the day yesterday was intermittent worship, like an intermittent retreat or an intermittent injection of worship into your soul. So that's where we are. Everybody good? Let's go to number three. Number three, and I'll do this one just to build off of our Q&A time. I'll go ahead and do this one as three, and that is rest. Not now. Don't go to sleep now, but later. There's a time to work, and there is a time to rest. And so Sabbath is a particular kind of rest, but Sabbath is a defined rest that is more than rest. But then there's other types of rest that you need as well, and rest is very important. And most of us run really hard. In fact, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and I have some just random thoughts at the end of my talk that I want to give you, but I do hold my staff accountable for these areas in their calendar. For example, my general theory on hiring staff has been to hire bulldogs. Where are we with the bulldog owner back here? Me and Daryl, the bulldog owner. So I've tried to hire bulldogs and put a chain on them as opposed to hire lap dogs and try to teach them tricks. And that's been my general approach to hiring. I want to hire highly driven, hard-charging, go-get-them kind of people. And I hire a lot out of the secular world. I don't feel like everybody I hire, and to contrary to some changes in America, I don't always see seminary education as a huge plus. But I used to hire a lot of investment bankers. And investment bankers are used to working 80 hours a week. Now, a lot of us toss around 80 hours a week, but if you ever think about it, 80 hours is a lot of time to work. I mean, I really, as hard as I push, I rarely work 80 hours. I mean, that's 7 days a week, 12 to 13 hours a day You take one day off as part of that. That's 14, 15 hours a day for 6 days. That's a lot of time. But these young investment bankers that come to New York, a lot of times that's their life. And then they'll come to Journey and they'll get saved and they end up being great administrative pastors or executive pastors. Or sometimes we don't call them an executive pastor because they don't know if they're called to ministry. So they're the executive director of your ministry or administrative director of your services or something like that. Well, they thought coming to work at Journey, where we only work 65, 70 hours a week, they thought that was great, you know. Man, it's just like they had to slow down to come to work for us. But then what I find, and there's particular theologies of this, where it's you don't work at all. You know, it's like I have to push you to work 40 hours a week, or I have to push you to work, you know, 50 hours a week. My general approach to work is that I get paid by the church to work 5 days a week, and then I voluntarily work the sixth day, which is Sunday. Because I ask everybody in the church to volunteer on Sunday, so I volunteer on Sunday. That really changed my perspective, by the way. So my church salary that I get, it pays me to be in meetings on Monday. It pays me to plan worship services on Tuesday. It pays me to prepare the sermon on Wednesday and on down the line. But then I volunteer on Sunday. And that just changed everything for me because now I'm no longer a hireling. I'm a called minister. And so I show up and exercise my gifts on Sunday just like the worship team does and like the children's ministry volunteers do and the parking lot and the greeters and all that kind of stuff. So I volunteer on Sunday. And then Saturday is my Sabbath or whatever day in the week it might be as part of that. But what I've tried to do is I've tried to hire these bulldogs that are really willing to work and then put a chain on them and teach them how to Sabbath. And I would rather do that than try to hire these lazy people and try to get them to work. And unfortunately, there is a lot of laziness in ministry. We are. I mean, you know, that's just how it is sometimes. But I have to hold my staff accountable to take the Sabbath. And that can be a problem. In fact, one of our year-end reviews that we questions that we ask is, how often did you take the Sabbath over the previous year? And there is the occasion to violate the Sabbath, but that should be once a year, twice a year at the very most. Maybe if there was a prolonged illness or something that took you out of the office, like the birth of a child for a while and, you know, something like that. But generally speaking, I want to hold them accountable. And so because of this, I have to also push my staff to rest. I have to walk around at night and tell them to lock it up, shut it down, go home, because there needs to be a time where you turn it off. There needs to be a time to rest. And I'm not just talking here about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a particular type of rest, but even every day. By a show of hands, how many of you have a hard time turning it off? Yeah, okay, so I got the right crowd for this talk that I'm about to do. I have a hard time turning it off. My mind gets on something, and I go home, and even if I'm with family, and I can be very focused and very disciplined, I'll get to family time and some of that here in a moment, but then, you know, the son goes to bed, Kelly goes to bed early, I'm a little bit more of a late night person than she is, I'll find myself turning it back on. And I say, well, I could just do one little more project, or let me just do one more reading of the book, or let me just put together this talk, or, well, I got the next three Sundays done, but let me just work on the fourth Sunday. And the next thing you know, it's 11 o'clock, midnight, 1 o'clock, and then I go in there, and I lay down, and I turn on the classic country music, and I just can't sleep. And so rest becomes really important. So when you think about rest, let's talk about sleep for just a moment. I have an article, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to reference it about sleep. If you're interested in that, maybe send me an email at the Renegade Pastor's email, and I can post it into your hub. It's by a guy who I really don't know, but he wrote an article on how to get better sleep. But there is a couple things I will point out. One is he says that according to research from Harvard Medical School, almost 33% of American workers and 66% of pastors... Okay, he really didn't say that. I just thought it sounded right. 33% of Americans are not getting enough sleep. As a result, they suffer from chronic exhaustion. And so that's an issue. And they're not functioning at peak levels. And he tells a great story in the opening about, you remember when in the Seinfeld episode, when Kramer was going to try to copy Leonardo da Vinci's sleeping patterns. Did you see this, Seinfeld? Because what Da Vinci would do is he would only sleep 20 minutes every 3 hours. And so Kramer's going to try to copy this, and that's the setup to this particular article. But then he goes on to talk about how much lost production is related to getting enough sleep, how much how many health issues are related to getting enough sleep. In gaining weight, they now say that you gain more weight when you sleep less than if you sleep enough. And so do you know, and I won't get into all this, I mean, he gets into things about keeping your room cool and powering off devices and having pre-bed rituals and all that. If you're interested and we have time, I can come back to the article. But as you think about your sleep, I think a good rule is, do you wake up in the morning rested? Or do you have to wake up with the alarm clock and hit the snooze button? Well, that says something is off. And sometime I'm going to give a talk about circadian rhythms and biological clocks and things like that, because I'm really fascinated. And a parenthetical study that I've done for much of my church systems work has been to study bodily systems and the way your body is wired up by God and try to match those two, and the stress and relief principle and some of that is a part of it. But with your sleep, are you simply getting enough sleep? Are you rested? And it's very, very hard to solve problems when you're tired. It's very hard to fight your shadow self when you're wore down, to pick up on that phrase from earlier. So sleep is important. In my own life, I get a lot more sleep. I have a hard time sometimes going to sleep, but I get more sleep than probably most people think. I'm not a 5 hour a night person. I'm not a 6 hour a night person. I really want 7 to 7.5, and perhaps on the Sabbath, more like 8 hours kind of person. And I've gone to bed, or I've left problems at the office that are so big and so overwhelming, and then had a great night's sleep and woke up the next morning and they seem so small. Now, I didn't, you know, the problem didn't change, but I changed. Sleep is restorative. You were meant to sleep. The other thing that's really impacted me regarding sleep has been something Wayne Cordero taught me. And Wayne Cordero taught me that tonight is the beginning of tomorrow. Okay, let me explain that. When God created the world, he separated dark from light. And it seems as if the night is hour zero, and then it goes into the day. In other words, I go to bed tonight not because I'm tired from today. I go to bed tonight to rest in preparation for tomorrow. Do you see how subtle that is? I know it's a little hard to get your mind around. But in the American way of thinking, tonight is the end of today. So, you know, my day started at 6 a.m. this morning, and it ends when I go to bed tonight. In the more Hebrew way of thinking, tonight is the beginning of tomorrow. So I go to bed as the start of my day. So I start the day with sleep, and then I end the day with work, versus starting the day with work and ending the day with sleep. And that little shift there has made all the difference in the world to me. And then Cordero taught me also that principle I gave you yesterday, which is if you're going to sleep in on the front end. You know, so I've got so much to do between 8 and 5 tomorrow, or between 8 and 6 tomorrow, I better go ahead and go to bed, you know, at 10 o'clock tonight. And that's been freeing for me. But sleep can be really powerful. More we could say on sleep, perhaps, but I'm just going to leave it there. But sleep is a very important part of rest. Also a part of rest is days off in addition to your Sabbath. So as hard as I worked you over about the Sabbath and how you're sinning and you're probably going to lose rewards in heaven and you probably lose your hair too if you don't take the Sabbath, then I would also say that there is a time for days off in addition to the Sabbath. Now, I think these should be more strategic than perhaps just randomly assigned or maybe something that you feel is an obligation that's due to you, an entitlement. So something that's more intentional versus an entitlement. Because there is a time to look at the busyness of your life and say, the seasons are so busy, the work is so much, I better plan some additional days off. And if we have time at the end, I want to talk to you about seasons just a bit and how the seasons flow into your calendar. But we're in a season right now. And now up until, say, April 5th, which is the week after Easter, that's going to be a really busy season. So it's going to be hard to get a day off with that. But an intentional day off after that busy season to allow you to rest from the busyness can be really, really powerful. And so you want to be strategic about that additional day off. Then connected also to this issue of rest are longer periods of rest. And I'm not so much talking about vacation. I'll get to vacation here in a moment. But taking a full weekend off can be really powerful. You were not created to preach 52 weeks a year, all right? I don't know if you've learned that yet. You're just not. I was joking yesterday about how in New York, in the Manhattan campus, they have 5 services. They have 4. They're adding a 5th. Sometimes they do 6, depending on special days and things like that. The torture you put your body through to deliver a sermon is just incredible. The adrenaline that floods your body, the intensity of focus that floods your body, that's just not natural. And then to do that week after week after week. I was telling you about Jim Lohr and some of his work about managing time versus managing energy. And Lohr developed this phrase that he called the corporate athlete. And he says that in every other sport, there's a season, except in corporate America. And so you think about professional baseball players, they work X number of months, and then they take X number of months off. You think about professional football players, they work X number of months, they take X number of months off. My brother, who was a professional bodybuilder for many years, yes, it does skip a generation, they would have a season where they competed, and then they had a season that he referred to as the fat season. And then, you know, then they would get back in shape and go back out and compete. We don't have that. You know, we're corporate athletes. We're ministry athletes. But there's not really a season of that. You know, we're expected to get up and to deliver and to preach week in and week out. And we just are destroying ourselves in the process because we will not take a weekend off. Now you say, well, okay, cut to the chase, Nelson, you know, not much time this afternoon and all that. What do you mean? I'm talking about number one, let's just start with 50 weeks a year, okay? Whittle that down. I think the least you can do is probably 40 to 42. Anything less than that, you're probably going to undercut your leadership unless it's a planned sabbatical or something of that nature. But if you're preaching 52, try to get it down to 50. If you're preaching 50, try to get it down to 48. If you're preaching 48, try to get it down to 46 or 44. And then you can do what I do. Sometimes you take weeks off, but sometimes you co-teach with somebody else. Tag team teaching, you know, where you teach the intro and somebody comes out and teaches the middle and you come back and teach the conclusion, or vice versa. And if that doesn't sound all that exciting to you, wait till you get to the point where you're doing 4 or 5 a weekend. Then it sounds really, really good to have somebody come in and take 20 minutes of the sermon off your shoulders. But thinking about taking a full weekend off, even one where you attend church, just as a regular, ordinary person, like we talked about yesterday, or taking one where you go down and visit another church. And again, I'm not necessarily just saying that you go to benchmark against them, but you can't help it. You know, you're going to go down, even if you try to go down and worship, you're still going to try to steal their ideas and load up on their brochures and ask questions and all of that. But that's part of this rest as well. You need a break from preaching. You need a break after the busy seasons of life. Now, if you do all this right, what you won't need is a vacation. But you should take it anyway, because the vacation ain't for you. If you schedule your preaching right, if you schedule your Sabbath right, and I know this sounds really crazy right now because some of you, the only time you rest is on vacation, but if you schedule your Sabbath right, if you schedule your days off right, if you schedule the days out of the pulpit right, you really won't need a vacation to rest, but you still need to schedule your vacation as part of rest because your vacation will be for those you love. And when I go on vacation, I don't want to veg out on the couch. I want to be able to be engaged with my family. And so that is a different kind of rest. And I do find clarity on vacation about issues and ideas and things that I can't find anywhere else. But vacation is part of this. It is a time to turn it off. So let's talk about vacations for just a moment. I heard somebody say, I'm going to attribute it to John Maxwell, because I think it was him, but it may not have been. And you know my idea, you know my general thought about attrition, don't you? About if you don't know who to attribute a quote to. If you have a quote but you don't know who to attribute it to and it's a spiritual quote, you just attribute it to Charles Spurgeon.
Right.
So most people don't know. He wrote a bunch of stuff anyway. It sounds really eloquent in the old English. So, you know, you just say, Charles Spurgeon always said. And most people say, well, he probably did say that. And then if it's like a sort of a secular quote, not so much a spiritual quote, you just attribute that to Winston Churchill. Because he said a lot of stuff. He wrote a lot of books. He's like a smart guy. So you just say, you know, like say you find yourself sometimes in this spot. You're up preaching and you realize you didn't attribute the quote in your notes. So you're saying, it's been said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, said Winston Churchill. And you'll be fine. You just keep going. People don't know, you know. And then if it's like cleanliness is next to godliness, Spurgeon always said, you know, and you just keep going. So I don't really know who said this, but I'm going to attribute it to John Maxwell. He said, you take vacation with your family when they're young so that you can remember the vacations when you're old. So my dad, who is not a believer growing up, he is thankfully, praise the Lord, one now, at least I think he is. Sometimes I can't get a straight answer out of him because sometimes your family's the hardest, but he you know, tells me that he is, and I believe him. But as I was a kid, there were certain things he just understood intuitively because I was the last of three boys. And one turned out okay, one didn't turn out so well, and the jury's still out on me. But because there was a vast age difference between me and the others, he had figured a few things out just in his life. And he had figured this vacation thing out. And even though he was a guy, he got up early in the morning and went to work. He came home, he had dinner with the family, then he went back to work at night. When he went on vacation, he took vacation. And I had a friend, and his dad had a very much a 9-to-5 job. I mean, he was just that traditional 9-to-5 union guy, you know, kind of deal. And he came home 9-to-5. Well, when they went on vacation, his dad was disengaged. He just laid on the couch, didn't want to go anywhere, didn't want to do anything with that. You can be the judge of that, and you can say I'm judging the guy too harshly or whatever. But one of the things I always knew is that when I, as a little boy, went on vacation with my dad, I had the attention. I had their focus. We were on vacation. Now, did they, mom and dad, do stuff they wanted to do? Sure they did. Did they drag me along to things I didn't want to go to? Sure they did, because, I mean, I was a little kid. That's their right to be able to do that. But my dad had understood that if he's going to work hard and do things, there needed to be a time where he could say, okay, family, you've got my attention. And then when I first went in ministry, a guy who was a mentor in a lot of ways to me really blew it in this area. And the only time he ever did vacation with his kids was to go to like the denominational meeting, and that was the vacation. You know, Dad would go vote and, you know, go to the denominational work, and they got to hang out at the pool or something. And I suppose that was okay, but I heard him later regret that. And, you know, being in ministry 20 years, you see things and you see kids grow up and all that. So not the tightest talk I've ever given here on vacation, but a time to turn it off and a time to take the vacation. And the busier you are, the bigger your ministry grows. If you're going to model Jesus, the more time you have to take off. And there is a time to just abandon. And one of the first things I think you should put in your calendar is your vacation time. And you block it out. One of my mentors who's going to be with us at the April meeting for our advanced coaching, he said, Nelson, you need to understand the power of a 2-week vacation. I said, 2 weeks? I've never taken more than 3 or 4 days. He said, well, you got to grow up, and you got to learn to take a 2-week vacation. So I started with 7 days. Learned a lot on the 7 days. In fact, he told me I should do a cruise. That's why I can't afford it. He said, check the prices. So I added up what I was going to spend in a hotel and food and travel, and I realized we could go on a 7-day cruise cheaper. And you get that inside cabin for like $500 a person. So, you know, Kelly and I went on this 7-day cruise, and then we got upgraded because my wife's really good at like building friendships with travel agents and people like that. So we ended up getting upgraded, and we had a little balcony and stuff. As part of that, and she to this day still gets us like all kinds of special treatment in hotels, and they like her and all that. But so we went on this cruise, and here's what I realized: the first 2 days, I'm still thinking about church. You know, the next 2 days, I finally disengage and I relax, and then the last 3 days on the cruise, the family had my attention. And then my mentor said, "Well, what if you could stretch that to 2 weeks?" And so now, you know, it takes you 2 days to disengage, 2 days to rest, but now you've got 10 days left to give the attention to the family. I'm still working on it. You know, I've taken a couple of weeks here and there, and I'm still struggling. I'm trying to move to the point where I take a full month off at one time. And you can't do that as a church planter. But when the church gets 10 years old and the church is like the journey and it gets more stable and you've got a team and you've got staff, you can, you know, move toward different things. But vacation becomes really important, making those memories. And vacation doesn't have to cost a lot of money. You know, if it's a $500 7-day cruise, you have to save up for that. None of this stuff comes easy. And if you have a credit card that you use for ministry stuff and then the church reimburses you, you can get credit card points. And a lot of times you get your airfare and hotel taken care of just from the points that you get on the credit card. Sometimes people joke at me because I'll go to a concert. I like to go to concerts. I've never paid for a concert. I just use credit card points. Because on my credit card, you can buy concert tickets, pretty good deal. It doesn't cost you a lot of points, so we do that. But then, you know, you can use that for airfare, and you can use that for a car rental and things of that nature. I once had a 7-day vacation where we went to Gettysburg and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., and a bunch of old Civil War sites, less than $1,000 for the whole week, you know, because you can do it. There's different ways to do it. Then there is a time to save up, you know. 10-year anniversary, my wife and I were supposed to go on a Greek Isles tour. Her dream had always been to go to the Greek Isles. My family's Greek. Circe is a Greek name. C-I-R-C-E. Anybody know what that means, by the way?
Church.
No, it does not mean church, but that would be really cool if it did. It actually means little gift.
Okay.
And sometimes people remind me that it's little tiny, little bitty gift. And I'm like, no, little gift. But anyway, so she always wanted to go to Greece. So we saved up, and then we go to book it, and that's when they had the Olympics in Greece. So you couldn't get a flight in, you couldn't get a cruise or whatever. So finally, last year we went. So 7 years later, we went on this cruise. And so she's gotten to know this cruise company because every year they call us, hey, are you going to go this year? So I went on a cruise 7 years later, but I paid the prices from 7 years prior when it was dirt cheap and all that. So there's a time to just save up and make some memories and do something like that. Your 10th anniversary, you know, that's one. Your 25th anniversary. That's one. My parents started celebrating their 50th anniversary at year 46. They just didn't want to risk not getting there, you know. So, but you're only 46. And they said, but we've always heard so much about the 50th. Let's just handle it. So rest is very, very important. Last thing I tell you on rest, and I'm very aware it's the afternoon session and all this stuff, but the last thing I tell you on rest is sometimes fun should be a part of your schedule when it comes to rest as well. That can be tied into your vacation. That can be tied into your days off. But, you know, you shouldn't feel guilty about having some fun. We were talking over lunch about some of the theological movements that are happening in America, some of which no longer believe in evangelism or church growth and different things like that. But there's also always been this undercurrent of Puritanism in America that says if it feels good, you probably shouldn't be doing it. You know, but there's nothing wrong with having a little fun. Fun can be very restful. You know, going to a concert, whatever stripe that is, whether it's you're going with me and we're going to see Alan Jackson or George Strait, or we're going to see Jimmy Buffett, or whether you're going to see the Foo Fighters, or, you know, I can't even think of anybody that would be modern day Adele, I guess. I like Adele. I don't know. You know, does she even give concerts? But whatever that is, I mean, you're going to watch the ballet. You see that? They do that in the movie theater. You know, you can go watch the ballet in the movie theater. I mean, what kind of world? It was just like, it's a modern-day miracle that you can do that. Whatever it is, there's nothing wrong with having fun. And look, if you've been working hard for 3 or 4 months, and on the Monday after Easter, you want to go to a movie, go to the movie. It's okay, you know. It's fine to have a little fun into your category. If you want to play softball on the Civic Softball League, play softball. You can get by with that every once in a while. There's something that's okay with that. And especially if it's part of this rest. Now, you don't want to do that and not do the church ministry stuff, okay? You still got to get your sermon done, you know? Sermon won't write itself at the movie. But a time to turn it off. And then when you rest, when you go on vacation, when you Sabbath, turn it off. Don't check your email. Don't be on text. Don't return phone calls. A buddy of mine, he says, I've got 2 phones. One that only my wife and family has, and one that the church has. And when I take my day off, I put the church one in the drawer. They'll be okay. They'll be okay. So be there. Be on the focus. Give it the time. Everybody with me? Okay. So now you're like, well, I've got the Sabbath. I've got my worship time. I've got my rest time. What else could you possibly say? Well, let me give you a parallel one to this. Number 4, I believe we're up to. I've called this date night. Date night. Date night. Finally. All right. Let me share this with you before I go to date night. This is a very bad transition here, but I want to go back, because if I talk about date nights and then talk about napping, that's not going to go very well together. But you guys know Mike Hyatt, the publisher of Thomas Nelson, used to be at Thomas Nelson. He sent me an article about napping. I want to go back to rest for just a minute, just to talk about rest. I've never been able to nap. Anybody in here able to nap? Yeah, a few. Good, good. Anybody napping right now? Okay. Apparently, Mike is a big nap taker. And he says, I've had almost one every day for years. And this is Spurgeon, by the way, was a napper. And I'm not just saying that because of Spurgeon. What he would do is he would lean back in his chair. This is true. It talks about it in one of his books. He would lean back in his chair with his keys in his hands. You know, back in those days, keys were like a big set of key ring kind of thing. By the way, if you ever want to know if you're doing too much or not, just look at the number of keys on your key ring. Because if you've got too many keys, you're just doing way too much. But anyway, he would lean back in his chair, and he would just grip the keys rather lightly, and he would nap, but he wouldn't go so deep, because what would happen is when he would get into it, and then it would wake him up. And he would say that was just enough to regain his focus, to regain his attention in doing so. So I was talking about that at a conference, and then I got this article about it. And so there's some interesting stuff here. Leonardo da Vinci took multiple naps a day. We talked about, you know, he slept 20 minutes every 3 hours, and he just kept working. I think he also went insane. But anyway, is he the guy that cut the guy's ear off, or that's Van Gogh that did that? I don't know. Yeah. I don't think this is necessarily in our favor, but Napoleon was also not shy about taking naps. He took one daily. Napoleon. Thomas Edison was embarrassed about his napping habit. He practiced it every day. Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of Franklin D. Roosevelt, used to boost her energy by napping before speaking engagements. Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, I was talking about Gene Autry the other day. Is Tommy in here? He didn't even know who Gene Autry was. He routinely took naps in his dressing room between performances. John F. Kennedy ate his lunch in bed and then settled in for a nap every day. I may try that. Oil industrialist and philanthropist John D. Rockefeller napped every afternoon at his office. Did you watch that, The Men Who Built America, by the way? Yeah, if you get a chance, I don't know if it's on Netflix or, you know, Amazon Prime or something, but there was a sort of a documentary about the men who built America, about Andrew Carnegie and John Rockefeller and all that. It's really interesting. Rockefeller, if you read the biography about him, the big Rockefeller book, he would sometimes sit in a meeting and he would sit outside of the conference room, like the conference room would, they would have the meeting, and he would just sit and listen. And they never knew if he was really listening or if he was taking a nap. But he would just absorb all this stuff. And then sometimes, like in the middle of the conference, he would come out with this brilliant solution. Winston Churchill took an afternoon nap. It was not negotiable. It was into his schedule. He believed it helped him get twice as much done. Now, there's another thing you should know about Winston Churchill, and this is true. This is not me just attributing it to Winston Churchill. He wrote all of his speeches in a bathtub while drinking a bottle of brandy. So half of that you could probably do. I don't think he'd be able to do all that, but he would like be so pruney in the bathtub where he's writing these speeches. Lyndon Johnson took a nap every day at 3:30, and he believed that broke his day up into two shifts. I was in vocational evangelism for 7 years, so I was usually in college, so I'd go to class all day, then around like 2 or 3 o'clock, I would shower and get dressed, and then I would either have to, back in those days, you could actually catch a flight like in a half hour, you know, and so, pre 9/11, you remember that? You could just like get to the airport about a half hour before your flight, and you know, I had to go run into the flight. So I would always have a flight like at 4 o'clock, or I'd have to drive somewhere, and then I'd land at 6, and you would speak, and then you could get back sometimes at 9 o'clock and be home, and I'd go to school the next day. And so that always, like, that shower in the afternoon, like that 2:30 shower in the afternoon, it seems like it gives me energy into the end of the day. Ronald Reagan famously took naps. So here's the benefits of napping. It restores alertness. The National Sleep Foundation, I'm sure you can trust them, they recommend a short nap of 20 to 30 minutes. Nap prevents burnout. Of course, a lot of cultures, they take naps. They have the siestas. heightened sensory perception, that was kind of Spurgeon's thing, reduces the risk of heart disease. Who knew? A midday siesta at least three times a week means you're 37% less likely to die of a heart attack. Working men are 64% less likely to die of a heart attack, and then it makes you more productive. So I have this chair that he talks about here. Michael says he has a zero gravity chair. You got one of those, Steve? You can get them at the Relax Your Back store. You ever been to the Relax Your Back store? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, so Google this when you get back home. I don't know if they have this in South Georgia or not, Carl, but if you drove to like the big city of Macon, I bet, or something, they would probably have it. So the Relax Your Back store is for people like me who have back pain. Anybody else? I have lower back issues. People always say, why do you sit down when I teach? Because I want to be able to walk out of here when I'm done. And so I have some lower back issues. It's from birth kind of thing or whatever. But you can go into the Relax Your Back store, and it's like the Brookstone store in the mall. You don't have to actually buy anything. You just get to use all the gadgets, you know. So I like to go in there and hang upside down. So they have one like right down from our office in Boca. And so I've had to like stretch my relationship with this salesperson for years, because I've been going in there now for 3 years just to hang upside down. I'm like, just one more time. Can I just try it one more time? Like, I'm thinking maybe if I didn't go all the way back. So like literally you put your feet in this thing and you hang upside down. And oh man. Like it just releases like everything, like in that area of your body that you shouldn't talk about, like you're behind. Like it just releases everything. And you walk out, you feel like you're like 2 or 3 inches taller. You know, you probably are in some ways, and it's just like upside down. So their big theory is that any day without gravity is a good day on your back. So they have this thing, and I've got one of them in my office, called a zero gravity chair. And it's got feet on it, and you would lean all the way back, and it's contoured so that there's like as limited amount of gravity on every part of your body. And so Michael says he naps in a zero gravity chair, so I'm going to have to try that. Pulling that thing over to the office. Anyway, be consistent, be short, turn off the lights, use a blanket, and be discreet. Those are his tips. So if you go to michaelhyatt.com, michaelhyatt, H-Y-A-T-T.com, it's a good blog that he does anyway. And so I was talking to my editor at Baker. I don't know who you work with at Baker, Gary. You ever work with Chad Allen? Chad and I were talking about this the other day. We're going to try to practice that, but apparently the office culture at Baker is not that conducive to napping. So, it'd be tough. But the worst time to nap is on your date night. So, I bet you won't find that at michaelhyatt.com. So let's talk about date night for just a bit. Jimmy Britt in here. Jimmy's outside getting ready for our next event. Jimmy Britt and I have been traveling together for a long time, and sometimes he goes with me to like other states and stuff, just part of my parole provision, not being able to travel alone. And we were down at some kind of little beach retreat, and one of the guys I was speaking with, he was just getting married, and his fiance came in for the weekend, and we were sitting around talking, and they asked me and Jimmy to give them some marital advice. And I give them my little expectations talk, you know, like the key to a happy marriage is really not low expectations, it's really no expectations in my part, because every argument is about me putting some expectation on Kelly that she's unable to meet or whatever. So I give them this little talk, and it wasn't that great. And kind of like this talk. And Jimmy says, you've got to schedule time for one another. Well, they're young, they're in love, they don't know any better. This just like wrecks her. And like she just thinks he's the biggest idiot in the world. And just gives him all the reasons. Like, I want him to be so in love with me that he doesn't have to put me on his calendar. Now, how many of you in here have been married for more than a year? And you realize that it's the exact opposite, right? It's the exact opposite. Love is putting the other person on their calendar. Now, certainly love is more than that. And being married is, you remember that book? It never did very well, but there was a book called The 2-Minute Kiss. And the theory was that you should kiss your spouse for 2 minutes every day before you leave. Now, I've been trying to get Kelly to buy into this. And some days, my wife's not here. I can't, you never want to tell too many stories. My wife's great if you've ever met her or whatever. But like, I have never quite been able to get her to buy into the 2-minute kiss kind of thing. But I have been able to seriously get her to buy into the date night. And usually it's not her, usually it's me. But the date night idea of having a time in your schedule that is carved out specifically for those that you love. Now, I would expand this, and I don't know if I have time. If we have time in our Q&A session, we can talk about it. I would expand it to not just a date night with your spouse, but also scheduled time with your children and grandchildren. Daddy-daughter date day. I hear that. Doesn't work so well with daddy-son, okay? But the idea is still the same. The grandparents' breakfast, the grandparents' lunch. Some of you are nodding your head. You have that. Most of us, we have treasured childhood memories of that. Whether it's just, I used to go to my, I only grew up with one grandmother. We called her Granny, but others had already died before I was born. And I would go there and we would have lunch. And that was a pretty standing Saturday kind of thing. Now my parents were probably doing date night. Who knows? My dad might have been trying that 2-minute kiss thing or something. But whatever it was, I would go there and we would make grilled cheese sandwiches. And man, there's hardly a time that I smell or see a grilled cheese sandwich that I don't think about, how much my grandmother loved me. And honestly, she was the only Christian in my family at the time. So who knows what kind of influence she had on me, because I was one of the first later to become a Christian after she died. But, that kind of principle of that scheduled time where you give some focused attention. Now, my mom grew up in a family with 7 or 8 brothers. One died young, but 7 that grew into adulthood that I knew as aunts and uncles. So it might be a little harder to have individual time with all 7. But the birth rate in America has gone way, way down. So most of us have the 1.4, and we're fine. But the idea here is to schedule specific time, primarily, first of all, among equals with your spouse. But then you can also filter this principle down to children and then at a certain stage to grandchildren. Now, with children, this could be applied, and I'm circling around children so I can come back to spouse, but, with children, especially grown children, this could be applied to a consistent time where you connect by phone, or as Matt and I were talking, with Skype, retired people are buying computers for Skype, buying iPads for Skype, because this is the way it works, and so now you don't just talk anymore, but you see, but it's that scheduled time. And there's some great benefits to having this scheduled time with your parents, because the commandment says that if you honor your father and mother, you will have years added to your life. So you actually live longer if you honor your father and your mother. So there should be time for that as well. So you can apply this in all of its various ways. There's a bug up here, not a cockroach or a palmetto bug, but some other kind of nasty bug. You can apply that in all kinds of ways, but primarily you want to apply this to your spouse. Now, should it be a weekly date night? Perhaps in an ideal world, it should be a weekly date night. I don't live in the ideal world. I live in the real world. But I think it should be scheduled. And weekly is great. Every other week, if you have to. 3 times a month, if you can. But having it scheduled, and here's the thing. Don't ever finish one date night without having the next one on the schedule. So first thing you want to do is get the first one on your schedule. And by the way, this could be a date lunch. You can get really creative. It could be a date breakfast. You take the kids to school and come back home and cook breakfast and have a date morning. It doesn't really matter, except that it's a focus time. And talk to the guys here just a moment. We all pursued our spouses before we were married, and then we stopped pursuing them after we're married. We call it taking them for granted is what happens. But you want to express the same kind of pursuit after marriage as before marriage. And so just as you would pursue them in dating, you pursue in this date night. And then take some of that creativity that you use to plan worship services and use that to plan your date night. Creativity is important. A little romance is important. And it does wane. Here's what I've noticed. Romance tends to peak in couples in their 20s, and then it comes back later when couples are in their 60s. And so let's try to close that gap. Bern, do you want to give a testimony of that? You just caught my eye. Like, I saw you and your wife coming in the other night. Yeah, I had a little look on their face. Bern was in one of my very first telecoaching networks, I believe. I met you before that because he's up in upstate New York. And so I'm leaving the hotel the other night after some kind of dinner. And they come giggling up like school kids down from, you've been down to Downtown Disney? Is that where you'd been? As far as I know, right? Yeah. And I'm out. And Burns like the only guy I know. It's like the longer I know him, the younger he gets. And you and Taylor Field down in the city. 65. And so it's great to have you here and great to see us. I saw them. I didn't say too much to them because I could tell they were a little embarrassed and holding hands and skipping. By the way, do you know it's impossible to not smile and skip? You can only skip and smile. This is true. You look like you don't believe me. I mean, I tell you all this stuff about napping. You're like, oh, yeah, that's true, napping. Oh, yeah, that's true. I'll write that down. Get that zero gravity chair. Go hang upside down. Guy said I should. You try it. It is impossible to skip and not smile. So you cannot skip with a frown. You know what I'm talking about with skip? Okay, like the little thing, you know, with that? Yeah. So you did it in kindergarten. And if you eat a grilled cheese sandwich while you do it, my grandmother will show up. No, I'm just kidding. All right, so it's afternoon. I got to lighten it up here a little bit. I don't have much else to say. I'm pretty much out of it. All right. So anyway, you know, it seems like, you know, in your 20s and early 30s, you do really well with the romance. And then the romance comes back. It comes back, you know, if you make it through, it comes back on the other end. And I think that's really cool. But I don't think you have to give it up in the middle there. And the reason why it gets so tough in the middle, you have little kids and, you know, the house is messy and you're tired and, you know, these are peak earning years and all that stuff that they say. But part of it is just intentionality. Intentionality with the date night. So use some of that creativity that you have in planning those worship services and planning the opening of your talk and telling the jokes and all that. Use that to plan your date night. And creativity is like a muscle. It's not like if you use it on your date night, you won't have any left for Sunday. Okay? You'll get more. It'll refill itself. And so you plan some creative dates. Now, finding what you and your spouse love to do, taking turns picking the movies, I'm sure there's plenty of stuff out there. In fact, I went to Focus on the Family. We had, I just threw H.B. London on the phone with us the other day. He used to run the minister's helpline at Focus on the Family, vice president there. And after that phone call, we were talking about some stuff, and he was saying something he didn't get to is date night. And so we pulled it up and Focus on the Family. They still have these articles that he wrote for pastors and date night on their website. So you can go to Focus on the Family. More recently, someone has written about it. You guys know Eric Geiger. Eric's written some great stuff in church planting, or excuse me, in church leadership. So this is not about napping here, is it? Okay, no, this is about. So where'd the intro go to Eric? Anyway, Eric was the co-author of Simple Church and. He's written some other great books. I just recently finished his on discipleship. But he has some thoughts. He wrote an article for Authentic Manhood, which they've never asked me to write an article for. Don't know what that says about me. But he wrote an article about date night. He says this, while there is not a biblical mandate to have a date night every week with your spouse, there is a command to love your wife as Christ loved you, Ephesians 5:25. How did he love us? Here's the quote. He pursued us when our hearts were cold to him. He continually wooed us to himself. He offered himself fully for us to establish an everlasting relationship, one that will endure for all time. Men often stop pursuing and dating their wives with the same passion with which they initially pursued them, and this is a poor reflection of the greater marriage we have with Christ. Let's bow our heads and pray together. So we can just close it up and go home. So when God confronted the church at Ephesus, he rebuked them for losing their first love. You go, Eric, and challenged them to do the things they did first. They had lost their intimate walk with the Lord, and he was calling them to repentance. There is a connection between losing your first love and stopping the things you did at first. Time with the Lord, sensitivity to his spirit, daily repentance, applied to marriage, the same is true. There is a connection between drifting from love expressed and the stopping of things we did at first. In other words, men, date your wife. Boy, that's just beautiful. Very, very well said. EricGeiger.com, EricGeiger.com. So he gives some tips, and his list is as good, if not better, than my list. So I just give it to you. Number one is schedule it. You've got to put it in the schedule. My principle is don't finish the next one until you have, don't finish this one until you have the next one scheduled. We practice at our house this principle I call living off peak, which a lot of you have heard me talk about. So Kelly and I rarely do date night on Friday night or Saturday night. The restaurants are just too busy. You know, it's hard to get tickets to the theater on those nights. or to the movie theater, or we're big fans of live theater, or we even like to go to comedy clubs and things like that. It's harder, and it's more expensive, too, a lot of times on Friday night than it is other nights. So our date night often ends up falling sometime during the week. We usually lead growth groups on Tuesday or Wednesday night, so sometimes Monday night can be a pretty good day for us. But Thursday night is often our go-to night for date night. But you put it on the schedule, and schedule it as a block of time, as much as you can, depending on your life stage. He has a second challenge, which is to start again. You know, if you miss a week or if you're out, just get back on track. Just because you got out of the habit doesn't mean you can't simply pick it back up next week. He has this idea of kid swap. I tried that one time, but the other kid just kept coming back. So it's like the baby changing station. You put your baby on there, he stays the same. He doesn't change at all. So kid swap. This is an excuse that you often hear about date night. Well, we can't afford babysitting. So I had to hold one of my staff accountable to this. So we were doing the year-end reviews, and I don't do everybody's. I just do the ones that report to me. And I asked him, I said, well, how are you doing on your Sabbath? And he said, great. I said, how are you doing on date night? It's just one of those things. It's not even on the list. It just kind of came to mind. And he said, well, not very good. So I happen to have $60 in my pocket, which is a rarity. And I had $60 in my pocket. I said, okay, here's $60. Get your next date night scheduled. And I said, until you get it scheduled, it's 10 points a week on the $60. You know what points are? So it's a 10% interest rate on the money I gave him, compounding weekly until he gets his date night scheduled. So at that point in time, I had this dilemma. On the one hand, I wanted him to schedule his date night immediately. On the other hand, I'm thinking that's $66 next week, $74 the week after that, $80. I could have like $100. If he would just delay it for like another month or two, I could get like $100 out of this deal. But anyway, he got it scheduled. And then gave me the $60 back. But the excuse was babysitting. And, you know, they have small children. And so how are you going to pay for the babysitting? I'm like, well, babysitting, you know, maybe you can swap. That's what Eric is talking about here. You find somebody to keep your kids this week and you keep their kids next week. There's always ways around it. Then the more we talked, the more we realized there were opportunities we were not taking advantage of. You know, there were parenting, like Gymboree kind of places in town that had parents' night out. Other churches that have that. They offer like a parents' night out. In Boca, it's such a wealthy, snooty area, they provide childcare at the movie theater. In fact, one of the top restaurants in Boca Raton is actually in the movie theater called I can't remember what the name of it is, actually right off, something with a B. But it's a really, really nice upscale, you know, kind of restaurant, not you know, Morton's or anything like that, but somewhere above Chili's. And you can go, and they'll even keep your children while you do that for the price of a movie ticket. So you buy an extra movie ticket for your kids, you can take them to the playground, they get to watch little kids' movies in there with all these certified, and it's like clean and safe and nice. And I know this is not for newborns, but, you know, later on, my son loves it. In fact, I was going to take him to see the new movie the other week. He didn't want to go see the new movie, he wanted to go to the playground. So I felt like I had to oblige him, and I went to see the new Stallone movie. Kelly's like, how'd it go with daddy son date day? I'm like, oh, fantastic. So, great. By the way, anybody else see that Stallone movie? Yeah, I didn't think so. It's like me and Carl, that was it. Nobody else saw it. The thing made like $400,000 or something like that. It made nothing. The only thing that did worse was that Al Pacino movie about the old guys. You know, it was going to kill each other, didn't do anything. So it was no Twilight. So you can be creative with the expense. And then date night, it doesn't have to cost you a lot of money. You know, picnic in the park during the warmer months can be pretty cool. Something at home, you can do a staycation date night. Just, you know, don't spend the time unloading the dishwasher or whatever with this. Eric goes on to say, you know, use this time to try something new. That's my words, not his. He says something slightly different in the article. But, you know, don't just fall into the same routine every week with your date night.